The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
I'm delighted now to be joined in the studio by Olympian and 2004 1500 metre European champion Ciara McGeehan. You're so welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Lovely to see you. I feel like I spent the weekend with you because I was reading the book, My Greatest Race. I could not put it down. Is that the sort of feedback that you're getting?
Yeah, and you know what? Sometimes I'm like, is that just my family telling me that?
No.
I'm like, nobody's going to tell me anything bad. But people have got in touch and they've let me know how grasping the story was, which is lovely. And it's a testament to Cliona's ability to
Cliona Foley, who wrote the book with you.
Yeah.
And you talk as well about sitting with her and going through the story, which I'm sure meant that you got to know each other so well over that
very
time.
Well. Cliona's followed my career as a sports journalist. And I think it was a really beautiful moment that we came together to write this book. I love that Cliona was there throughout all of that. So she knew the intimacy of the sport, but she probably didn't really necessarily get to know me. Mm-hmm. And she was wonderful. She was there for me throughout this whole book journey, nearly as a therapist as much as a co-author. But she did a phenomenal job because everybody tells me my voice comes across well in the story and in the book. And that's, look, it's a testament to her fantastic writing ability.
And, you know, when I was thinking about you coming in, I was thinking about the fact that it's been quite a week for you because, you know, since the Irish Times piece came out, and I know you've been speaking publicly in other interviews as well about your diagnosis. But that's the first time that we really got the detail on it.
Yeah.
What's that been like for you?
It's been interesting because I feel for the people who are interviewing me because it's very raw for you that you're reading the story and suddenly now is probably the first time that maybe people are grasping that it's stage four. And I know that early doors, many people probably thought it's an early stage. That's what I hoped myself at my initial diagnosis. I've been processing it for a long time. So I think people are surprised at how candidly and how open I am with discussing like the depths of this chemo journey and this cancer journey. But listen, me and my family have been having the really dark days throughout this past year of processing that. Now, it also has been a little bit raw. And I'd say actually for me, the biggest thing is whenever people give me feedback on the book or on my interviews and realising how much my journey and my story is touching others. It's something that I really hoped would be the case. But I probably didn't just fully appreciate just how much it might be a positive impact for those that are going through a tough time.
Have you had all of those messages? I'd say you have.
I have. And they've been so lovely. And people reaching out and telling me that hearing me verbalise how I've been feeling throughout this journey and my concerns for my family. It's been really nice to hear from other cancer patients to let, you know, they just want to let me know that this is something that they're going through too, and that thank you for verbalising it. And like even last night, I chatted to Michael Dara, was there. Obviously, we had an amazing time on Uncharted. And talking to his sister, who's been through such a tough journey herself, I realised that it's not just people who have cancer that are going to maybe read this book and resonate with it. And talking to her about how difficult that is, I'm talking about trying to get second opinions. And they're obviously there promoting organ donation, which is, I would strongly urge people, because I wouldn't have appreciated that the numbers are dropping, which is insane.
Yeah.
And you know, sharing my story gives me an opportunity to say how tough this has been, but in finding the joy in every day. And it's something that people I hope have taken away from the book, because
it just, you know, what struck me reading it was just it all happened so fast. And of course it happens fast, life happens fast, but it's just like you went from Paris and what happened there to this.
Yeah.
And it's all still so new almost. I mean, you mentioned there we're processing it for the last year. That's still really quick, you know?
Yeah, it's been a, sometimes I'm like, when am I going to catch a break? Because obviously I went from the highs of my European championship gold to then having to withdraw from the Paris Olympics. And I literally left there and launched myself straight into ankle surgery and the rehab and really focused on being there for LA. And that was my all-consuming focus. And then I get dealt the worst news of my life, that I have cancer. And then I find out it's stage four. And you know, for anybody's life, that is an absolutely crushing moment. But sprinkled in throughout that, I have lost that was the end of my athletics career. I didn't really get to process that completely. I was told that more than likely I won't be able to have a family. That news alone is tough for anybody. But it's just a small aspect of this big picture because I'm suddenly faced with my own mortality. And I suppose the book gave me an opportunity to actually come to terms with some of those things. I wouldn't say that they're fully processed, and I don't know if they ever will be, but it just gave me an opportunity to revisit some of the things from my athletic career, both the highs and the lows, and begin to process those. It also gave me an opportunity to put down in words how I was feeling throughout this cancer journey. And that's been something that's been very cathartic for me. And I do want to emphasise, because it seems like I'm really happy and joyful, and like I managed to handle this extremely well. I have terrible days where I'm sitting on the sofa and I can't get myself up, and really tough days post chemo, but also just the days where my brain is just like, I'm sad today, and I'm just going to say, stay sad today.
Yeah.
And you need that moment.
And why did this have to happen to me? Which is, I think, what we would all be doing. There was one thing that you did in the book a couple of times, I think, where you got news from doctors and you kept it really tight. Just your sister and your partner, and you left it at that. And I thought, how did you do that? And then I wondered whether your athletics career helped with that, because sometimes when you were injured, you didn't want any of the competition or the coaches to know that you were injured. So you kept that really tight. So was that practice for keeping stuff back from your family when you felt that you needed to?
Yeah, I suppose it's maybe a little bit in my nature where I just didn't want to make them sad. And I thought, okay, I'll wait until I can sandwich some good news into here, into the bad news. So it's maybe a little bit of that empathetic side on my part. But I will definitely say there's so many skills and attributes that my athletic career have given me that have really helped on this cancer journey. The resilience and the ability to take on bad news and say, okay, we're going to focus on the process and what we can do next. I think that's something that I definitely honed during my athletic career. And the ability to deal with bad news is something that everything in life, the more you practice it, the better you get. But yeah, I was a fairly private person, as open as I always was with my interviews and sharing that. I was a very private person whenever it came to the low points in my athletic career. I kept that really close. So yeah, I'd say I was honing that ability. And I'm not saying that's a positive trait. I definitely then, whenever the time was right, told my family and told my friends.
You did, of course. But you were, I mean, that time over Christmas where you held back. I mean, I think if it was me, I'd want to tell my mammy and, you know, my daddy straight away. But you didn't. You said, no, I'm not going to ruin Christmas for them, because that's what you felt the news would do. And you kept it to yourself.
I did. Well, I say myself, per Myra, my big sister, and Thomas, my fiance, they had the news too. But I felt like our Christmas was going to be tainted already with the sadness that I'm going through a cancer journey. I just didn't think they needed to be told that my prognosis was maybe 2 to 3 years on Christmas Eve. And I knew, like, I had just had some scans. I knew I was waiting for my PET scan and the results of that. And I'm like, look, I'll wait until I have the full picture and all of that to then tell my family. And look, I remember telling my mummy about my 2 to 3 year prognosis. I was sitting in a coffee shop in Belfast and she'd come up and I was like, okay, now's the time. I'm going to have this little moment. And I remember telling my daddy, we had brought the dogs out and we were walking down a lane and I let my daddy know, and I still get emotional thinking about it, because I said, like, the doctor said this and he had an inhalation of breath. He's like, don't tell me that. And we just had a hug and I'll go and cry on your radio station today.
I don't blame you, because it's just so tough. Do you know what? It's so unfair.
It is. Yeah. And it's one of the, I had an appointment with a well-renowned sports psychologist and psychiatrist, Dr. Steve Peters. And it was post-Paris and I was processing that, which, you know, seems like insignificant in comparison to the journey that I'm on now. But there was a message that we were going through, and it's a very simple one. And it seems quite harsh if somebody says it to you up straight, but he has a principle on the chimp paradox. I won't get into it, but he was like, there's a part of your brain that thinks the world should be fair and that everything should be fair. And I definitely identify that. And he goes, but the world is not fair and life is not fair. And so sometimes in those moments, as harsh as that seems, I remind myself whenever I think, why am I going through this? I'm like, well, life's not fair. So
I know. And I've heard that from people before, rather than saying, you know, why me? It's a case of saying, why not me? You know, this can happen to anybody, but it doesn't make it any easier, does it? So then you had that prognosis and then you had the results of the PET scan, which were good or more positive, right?
Yeah, I definitely did. I had that prognosis of from the physical scans, and then the PET scan is the one that shows up activity in tumour cells in your body. And they showed that the tumour cells in my bowel were currently inactive, the tumour cells in my lungs were inactive, and that they had greatly reduced in my liver. There were still three patches that were active, but even if I referred to them glowing on the screen, they were glowing at a much dimmer light. So it showed that I was responding to the chemotherapy, which was amazing. So I was like, okay, well, this is good because I can maybe pepper in the bad news and give, you know, everybody says you should have that, like that little sandwich of good, bad, good. So it gave me an opportunity to tell my family that. And listen, throughout this whole journey, we have tried to keep the hope and maintain that hope. And I jumped on a call recently, a support group, a bowel cancer support group, chatted to a lovely bunch of people. And one lady shared her story where she was diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer in 2016. And I didn't envision I'd cry jumping on this support group. But hearing her speak about her journey, how at prognosis she was given 6 to 12 months and told surgery wasn't an option. And here, 10 years later, she's still obviously on this horrible journey and she's still getting treatment, but she's here. I didn't know if I would last 6 months. I didn't know if I would last a year. And now I am just over a year after my diagnosis. I don't look like I have cancer. Everybody's telling me how wonderful I look. I'm like, thanks very much. And I'm hoping long may it continue because I'm hoping to get married. I do joke, we're viewing venues and it seems like a shotgun wedding because they're like, when do you want to get married? I'm like, September, October, please. And as everybody knows, Ireland is a beautiful venue for weddings, but most people book like a good chunk
way
in advance.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, me and Thomas are going and like, have you any dates? Any dates coming up? Just, you know, what's available? Because the reality is, I don't know. I don't know what the results are going to be after my next set of scans. I don't know if they're going to say, we're going to give you more chemotherapy, you can have surgery. And even at that, that's such difficulty of booking something. And I think it's something that really resonates with people on a journey like mine.
So when will you have the next set of scans and tests done?
I have a CT scan due at the end of June and my next PET scan is mid-July. I'm pursuing some second opinions. I had a lovely conversation with a doc from down here in Dublin, an oncologist here in Dublin this morning. I'm going to nip into him next week. So everything is constantly evolving and moving, and it is a difficult thing. I'm obviously being treated at home in the north in the NHS. I'm going to get some second opinions from some of the hospitals within the NHS. Mm-hmm. My MDT team is going to approach other hospitals for that advice. There's a hospital in New York, Sloan Kettering, that is really pivotal and kind of on the forefront of new research into bowel cancer in particular. I'm going to try to reach out to them, and the doctors that I'm with and the doctors that I'm getting opinions from have connections there. It is tough because whenever you start reaching outside of that, all of this stuff costs money. And
yeah, there's that. But there's also, and I know you make a point of this towards the end of the book, there's the bit about living your life as well. And you made a point of going to things and doing things and turning up for, you know, you were telling me you were going to a wedding this weekend. So you have to do all of the medical stuff, mm-hmm. pursue all of that, but also make sure that you are
living my life,
enjoying things. Yeah.
Yeah.
You seem to be doing a fairly decent job of that.
I'm trying. And don't get me wrong, there's days whenever I was on the chemo, I would be MIA for a week. I would just be in bed and feeling very ill. I had a syringe driver to try to get the drugs into me because I was vomiting my anti-sickness pills up. So there is days where I just have to listen to my body and stop. But equally now, whenever a friend sends a message through, do you want to come to something? I'm like, I'll obviously look. I'll be like, make sure there's no hospital appointments that day. Yes, I'm going. Do you want to grab a lunch? Yeah. Ellen Keane had tickets to Kingfisher in Belfast. She had messaged. I'm like, right, Ellen, we're going. Do you know, there's so many little things that I'm like, yeah, grasp that. Because we all go through our lives and opportunities come up and we're like, oh, I'll fit that in. Oh, do we have... This diagnosis has probably given me a whole new perspective on life, that there's nothing guaranteed. Of course, I've been given a horrible diagnosis and it's made me think of my own mortality at an age in life where you probably really feel that you shouldn't have to. But none of us are guaranteed tomorrow. And this has been an important lesson for me to find that joy in every day. I do joke that, you know, say me and Tommy have a row in the house. I usually am like sitting there and I'm like, ah, do you know what? I have a couple more years left if that was the case. And sometimes it's hard because I don't want to give that oxygen. I don't want to give it, but I have to face that reality. I'm like, if my time is limited here, I don't want to waste any time falling out with the man I love. I'm going to go and be like, I don't want to fight with you. You're wrong about that thing, but I'm not going to fight with you. And yeah, it's given me that outlook and it's something I've shared. And it's whenever people have sent messages in, it's something that's really touched me where somebody's like, I've been out for a walk and I was listening to Kira and it's made me stop and look around and just appreciate the beauty in every day. Mm-hmm. And you know, that beauty can be amazing things like I'm looking forward to my wedding, but it can be the smallest thing. Like I have two cats and a wee dog and the excitement in my wee pup's face whenever I come down in the morning. there's nothing that beats
hard
that.
To beat. Yeah.
And I'm like, just take a moment to just the mundane things that you think are normal, which quite often, you know, it's parents say it's like you don't realize the joy of pitter patter little feet and dirty handprints on windows until they're grown up and they're out of the house. And it can be an absolute nightmare chasing them around, but you'll miss it whenever you don't have that. And it's so tiring in the moment. Like, and so many of my friends have little infants right now, and they'll be messaging in being like, oh, for goodness sake, this happened and we had a punami on the way to whatever. And then I'm like, obviously we share everything. And I'm like, girls, you're so lucky. And that's not to take away from the struggles of being a new mommy. But I'm like, you get to have those little cuddles. And that's just so beautiful. And it's like, obviously I get extremely emotional because I would always have wanted that. But I'm lucky. I have little nieces and little goddaughters that I cuddle. And, you know, I'm going to relish that.
Listen, you're being very positive. And I know, because I've read this and I know that that's not always the case. And there are tough days. But you mentioned Tommy, as you call him, Thomas, to give him his full name. I kind of fell in love with him myself a little bit. I mean, talk about somebody who's right there throughout the athletics career, throughout all of this. He's just there, isn't he?
Yeah, he's been my rock. I do joke that Thomas is a very quiet man. Is it any wonder? Because you can't get a word in edgeways. But he's just been that constant for me. We met in UCD. He was my best friend, Shauna's little brother. So thankfully it's worked out. And he's been that steady for me throughout my highs and lows of my athletic career, throughout this journey. He's a very stoic man and he hates me talking about him. So he'll be raging that I mentioned him.
I made her do it.
But I'm so blessed to have a partner in life like Thomas and, you know, a best friend in the man that I'm going to marry. And I hated how much he gave up throughout my running career. He is a runner himself. And he would come and he would pace me throughout the summer and miss all of the races that he wanted to run. And I'd feel absolutely devastated. But he was like, I want to do this. I want you to achieve all of your dreams on the athletics track. And I really hoped that, you know, whenever I hung up my spikes, I could switch that. And Tommy's wanting to, you know, run a marathon. And I was like, great, I'll jump on the bike and I'll be now your training partner. And I'll be the one that's helping you. And then I get this blooming diagnosis and poor Tommy's the man that's holding a bucket and who's emptying it. And, you know, there's nothing like a bile cancer diagnosis to bring a whole new wave of experiences into your house.
Changes things, I can imagine.
The dynamic certainly switches up. But I'm just so lucky that he's never even winced at any moment of this.
Yeah, that shines through in the book, though, that he is really special and that you appreciate the bones of him. I want to talk to you a bit about sport as well, because I loved how Camogie is woven through the book. Like, that is your first love when it comes to sport.
100%.
You were pains to say I wasn't a dirty player, but you were competitive. You were on six teams at one stage.
Look, like any little rural team. And it was before probably the rules came in that the youngsters, I've been training with the seniors since maybe under 12, under 14. I was like, get me out to every training session going. Absolutely loved the sport of Camogie. And it's something that, you know, like Tommy's like, you never stop talking. You're doing athletics now. But I was like, I feel that I owe it. And it's something that I've had throughout my life and my career. Is like, I like to thank the people and the things that made me the person I am. Camogie is where I cut my teeth in sport. It was my first love, and the passion that you feel as a child doing your sport and a teenager doing your sport is incomparable. You know, as you get older, you have probably more of an objective look on careers. But yeah, whenever I put the blue and yellow jersey on of Portaferry, I would run through a brick wall. And I was a tough player and definitely didn't spare any punches on the pitch with regards to tackles. But I feel
and
like
you clearly missed all of that team element when you went into athletics. I know you were with the New Balance team in Manchester and there's a different sort of dynamic there, but I got the impression that you loved that sense of being part of a team.
Yeah. And you know that identity, look, it's something that's so unique to the GAA, that sense of parish, that sense of this is us and we're representing our little town. That was the Camogie team that I grew up in. They were my friends from school. I'm from a small town. We all know each other. And you know, the passion that you have behind your own team, I missed that. And it took me a long time to find that. Like, obviously I felt so passionate about racing for Ireland, but I got to race for Ireland once or twice a year. the rest of the training was felt very lonely, having come from an environment where I had my sisters, my cousins, my best friends around me. And I'm glad to say I eventually found that in the sport of athletics. I'll emphasise in the fact that I didn't join an athletics club at a young age. So many people feel that in their athletics club. But I just suddenly appeared on the scene as this good little youngster in school and ran for my school and then got on the Irish teams. And then whenever I eventually did join an athletics club, I wasn't training with them and I was heading off to university. So I didn't really
have... Just a different experience to the team one.
And so many people will have that experience with their athletics club. I will not do athletics a disservice by saying that it isn't there for that. It just wasn't my experience because I wasn't there as a grassroots player. But I certainly had it in Camogie and I still love it.
I knew before I read the book that you had a really special relationship with Gerry Kiernan as your coach, but it wasn't until I got into the details of this that I realised just how much he meant to you. I mean, he was trainer, mentor, friend, and you still miss him, and I know that.
Yeah.
How important was he to you?
It's funny, like yesterday I chatted to Mary, my mother-in-law-to-be, and she's like, God, you got choked up talking about Gerry last night. And I was like, and somebody's like, I think you always will. And I feel like in life, there's a handful of people that make a lasting legacy. And of course, in your journey through life, there's amazing people that add little bits. But there's some that whenever you look back, that you're like, that person was so important in that moment in my life and so important in the person that I've become. And Gerry and everybody who knew Gerry, I feel like he was that person to so many of us. I'm so lucky that I got to be coached by him, but so lucky that I got to know him as a person. And he helped me figure out who I was as a person, because I joined UCD. It's always difficult. You're a little rural kid coming to a big campus. There's more people in that campus than there was in my hometown. So that's really daunting. And then I got injured and I didn't run. And I had this real identity crisis of, I am the runner. That's what I was known as at home, but I'm not able to run. And who am I if I am not the sport that I am competing in? And Gerry taught me that I am Kira and the value in just being me. He called me Ragazza. He loved Italy and the Italian language. And I'm fairly sure that's probably what I was saved as on his phone. He would pop round to the house with some liver for me to eat because I struggled to get my iron levels up. Like, this is the type of person that Gerry was. And if there was no liver, he gave me black pudding, which was a little more palatable. But I did joke. He would just arrive at the door, knock the door, because whenever I lived in Rathgar, he only lived a stone's throw away. He'd not rattle the door. He's like, put that in the fridge. We're grabbing a coffee across the road. And I would sit. And, you know, many people would look and it's like, what did you have in common with this older man? So much. So much. He was a young soul. He would talk about everything. And we would sit and talk about global politics, the state of current affairs, rarely touched on athletics. And that's what I loved about him. And he was a constant teacher. Mm-hmm. I did joke. There was a gentleman yesterday at the book launch said he knew Gerry from the bookies. And I was like, I can remember telling Gerry, I have no idea how to place a bet and what all of the odds mean. And there was another opportunity for him to teach me. Okay, come on, Kira. And off to the bookies we went. And
full lesson.
A full lesson. And I'm terrible. I still don't fully grasp it. And it's probably a good thing. I'm not putting any bets down.
No, don't grasp that one.
No, I won't get into that. But
I wanted to ask you as well about athletics and support for athletics. I know you acknowledge the professional bodies, athletics aren't, and everything else in the book. But as I was reading it, I went, is it a sport where you need to have the grant and the sponsor and a really supportive family to be able to do this? Because that part where you talk about being in UCD and the track is suddenly ripped up and not replaced for years, and the way you had to train, you know, even with Gerry, who wasn't taking any money, you know, I mean, it just sounds like something that happens by chance rather than by design. Is that fair?
No, I wouldn't say by chance, because look, we have support structures around us. To excel in the sport of athletics, there is an aspect of chance in the sense that you're not going to be a world-class athlete without being born with a certain amount of talent. There is that aspect there. But you need to nurture that talent. And we're so fortunate in Ireland to have such amazing grassroots in our sport. And I pay homage to them in my acknowledgements at the back, because without those local coaches who actually aren't there in the glistening days of an Olympic Games.
Yeah.
But without them in all sports, we would not have our high-performance athletes. But I will acknowledge that it is tough in athletics. In other sports, the pathway is a bit clearer. You join a team and teams are sponsored and they have a rake of money and you move between all of that. in athletics, we have our governing bodies. If you reach a certain level, you get to have your grant and you get looked after there. But I was at an Olympic Games talking to some of our golfers and they couldn't believe the sum of money that we earn in our sport. You're not going to be a millionaire from athletics. You're not going to be able to retire on the money that you earned. And actually, most of my counterparts on the Olympic team had jobs. Many of them were teachers. Many of them were still working alongside being Olympians and training.
Incredible.
And it is something I will say I've been extremely fortunate throughout my career. I have had the support of the Irish Sports Council on my grants there. I have been a New Balance athlete since I first went pro and they've been there for me. And I'm so lucky to have other sponsors that have come in, Lidl, 123, KPMG. You know, there's so many that have been there for me and I'm very fortunate in my agent Sinead that she's helped with that. But I am so aware that I have other counterparts on the track that it is tough. So yeah, I encourage anybody if they can get out there and support athletes. The Gerry Kiernan Foundation was set up in Gerry's name with that aim, to be able to help athletes financially, to be able to go and excel in our sport, because it is tough. And I hope people appreciate that whenever they're watching the Olympic Games, that many of your athletes out there who are representing our country in the highest stage are doing that while also holding down a job, while figuring out we need to be our own accountants. We need to figure where our money's going to go and how to make it last. There's so many aspects to being at the top of your game in athletics that I'd say the general public don't appreciate.
Well, we've only really scratched the surface, because I wanted to talk to you all about your four Irish records, because you still hold them, don't you?
Yes,
800, for now. 1,000, 1,500 and the mile. And the mile is there as well. And of course, you have the European gold, you have the bronze, you have the silver, you have two Olympics under your belt.
Yeah.
Not the third. You were there for the third.
I know.
Yeah, let's not even.
I was able to tip my hat at it, but I didn't get to toe the line. Yeah.
Kira, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I'm delighted you were able to come in.
Thank you so
and
much.
And I enjoy the book so much. And I sent you a message over the weekend. I just couldn't put it down. I could not stop reading it. I was with my family and I said, leave me alone. Oh. I'm busy. I'm with Kira and I'm staying with her. It's called My Greatest Race by Kira McGeehan with Cliona Foley. Read it. That's all I'd say. Read it. And Kira, thank you.
Thank you.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.